Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. I'm pleased to say back on home ground is Thea Leonarduzzi. We're recording this podcast slightly late because I moved house yesterday and now can sympathise with her struggles to become a feudal landlady.
How many acres are we talking? Are we talking hectares?
Hectare. It's not that big. Although I feel exhausted because I spent all of yesterday carrying boxes upstairs.
Need some peasants.
Well, I tell you what, there is a psychological reason I do it. I feel emasculated when I'm around people who work hard for a living and work manually and sort of with strength. So whenever I'm with them, I feel I have to show I can do it as well.
And do you start saying things like lads and cheers, mate, and things like that?
Not quite, but I did by the end. I was like carrying very heavy boxes for 5 hours to show that I could still do it. And I was kind of competing with them, and they obviously didn't know that I was competing with them.
Mm.
So and they weren't competing with me. So they were sort of going off and having crafty fags and stuff like that. And I was just sort of carrying on to show that I could still do it.
When we were moving, we packed so many more things into one box than you were supposed to. And it was mostly books.
Yeah.
And so when the people came to move us, they just sort of refused to lift them
because
they were so heavy. So my husband and I were just doing most of that lifting by ourselves, trying to be really strong about it.
You have to bring it back to books, don't you? Yeah, I thought we were exploring all sorts of things, you know, exploration of the masculine soul there. But oh no, I've got too many books. Exactly, and it's and they looked at me. I was like, yeah, that whole wall.
Yeah, is this a joke?
Yeah, it's like, no, this is not a joke. And I'm also competing with you. And you don't realise.
And I know someone who once asked the movers to transport an unused kind of an unopened bag of bricks, which does just seem like a joke.
That seems
like,
unfair.
I've got some bricks.
Yeah.
They need to
Did
go
they say
as
no?
well. No, they took them.
Yeah. That's heartwarming. So anyway, we're here, which is very good. If you're listening to this and not subscribing to the TLS, have a quiet but stern word with yourself, then head to your phone and Google TLS subscriptions. We'll wait here while you do that. Coming up on the show this week, while we squabble on social media and moan about the restless contingencies of modern life, the world is being slowly poisoned, the environment destroyed. Why don't we care about such an apocalypse more? TLS staffer Claire Saxby has reviewed 3 books on the subject and is here to offer an answer. Now, that Caligula, did he get a bad press or what? Famous for his sexual excesses and the hashtag fake news claim that he made a horse a senator, he's the subject of a new fictional treatment in a novel by Simon Turney. Classics editor and national treasure Mary Beard will tell us the truth about the man. And last week saw the end of the tenure of Arsene Wenger as Arsenal manager, a role he appeared to be literally named for. History editor and Arsenal fan David Horsepool has some thoughts to share with us. Claire Saxby's piece this week begins as follows. There's no issue so huge, pressing, or as diffuse as the degradation of the natural environment. In spite of this, the thought of it doesn't stir up much of an emotional response in inhabitants of the developed world. And she's surely right about that. I presented a radio phone-in show for 3 years and know from bitter experience the stony silence in response to a debate about, say, climate change. Indeed, I once did an hour asking, why does nobody care about the environment? It remains a good question. It's for several reasons, I reckon. The fact that we are individually too small and the problem too large. That the price will be paid most keenly by generations later than our own. And that fatigue we feel with dire prognostication that robs them of their force. So how do we get past, as Claire puts it, our denial and despair? She joins Thea and me in the studio now. Claire, hello.
Hello.
So why is this such a... I mean, really, all three books are there to try and say, why is this such a difficult, incommunicable subject?
Well, I think a large part of it is to do with scale. It's kind of both in terms of space and time. Yeah. It's really hard to kind of wrap your head around something that's happening everywhere simultaneously in so many different forms and in different ways, more than we could sort of even begin to hope to get to grips with.
And we're so small. Do you think there's a combination of it being big and we're... Because if you stopped throwing away plastic, the argument is, well, China throws away 4 billion tons of plastic, so your efforts are meaningless.
Yeah, it's the same with any problem, I suppose. We kind of need it to be more personal, more like immediate. Like we like to have things that are really intimate and specific. Like with the refugee crisis, like it was that picture of Alan Kurdi washed up on the Turkish beach, and then suddenly people like sat up and got angry about it. But there isn't really a corresponding image you could use for climate change or for the environment as a whole because it's so diffuse.
When people do find an image, it's a polar bear.
Yeah, exactly. And they're quite
that polar bear walking around in supposed to be the it is the Arctic.
It's on a small floating fragment of ice.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Or there's that one which is wandering through like there's no ice at all.
Oh, yeah. Yes, just getting thinner and thinner and then lying down. But this focus on the polar bear is obviously a problem.
Yeah.
Why, though? Because people care about animals in this country, for example, more than they care about people, largely. Why do we not care more about cold animals?
Well, I think it's just a bit reductive to have such a cliched image sort of associated with such a concept that's actually really complex, and it's about more than just melting ice caps. It's about societal structures and how we see our energy use and things that I just think that reducing it to one animal out of millions of different species that we don't necessarily feel this emotional tug.
I suppose it's not just even this, the one animal, it's the fact that if you think about the polar bear, you're localising in a very specific part of the world, whereas what you say in your piece so well is that it starts with the soil under everyone's feet. That's almost the beginning with what we need to start dealing with now is the quality of our own soil.
Yeah, I think making it specific to places that people are in who have the power to make changes, who have the power to, if it's donate money or make like lifestyle changes, but making them engage with their immediate environment rather than thinking they're just helping some distant Arctic space that they're never going to interact with.
One of the books is called Mourning Nature. Is the problem here that we mourn nature too little or too much? Because you can get both. I've heard both arguments that we're so grief-stricken we're paralysed, or we're not really that bothered, therefore we don't do anything.
I definitely think that all the books actually make you think about this weird kind of dichotomy between like feeling too little and feeling too much, because either we don't feel like it has any relevance to us in our daily lives, or we suddenly kind of get this wave of horrible empathy and depression and we shut it away because it's a bit too, it's overwhelming, it's too much to cope with. But I think what Mourning Nature, one of the books, was really good at raising as an idea, was that mourning can be this really helpful process for getting past that initial kind of overwhelming wave of feeling, because it structures your emotions and it like gives you a process to work through. Like she talks about traditional Jewish mourning practices where people... the mourners say the Kaddish and they have to say it every day for up to a year, and it forces them to kind of stop what they're doing and focus on the person that they've lost. And I think often in secular or Western societies, mourning is quite a personal thing. It's really private. People kind of retreat into themselves and they don't interact with other people, and it's actually quite counterproductive. But by looking at these other models of mourning, we can imagine new ways to like come together and actually move past it.
But people have still got to care. I guess the problem is that there's often this world, you feel people are writing and preaching to the converted, because there's a bunch of people who read these books, one imagines, who care deeply about the environment and ecological catastrophe, and there's a whole world out there that doesn't care, who will never really mourn. How do you bridge the gap to them? Do they even consider that as a problem?
I think it's really difficult to, when you're faced with like blanket denial, to really know how to navigate your way around that, because it's like putting up a wall. It comes, I think, from people being scared and being defensive and wanting to protect themselves and their own.
Do you think that's where climate change denial comes from?
Yeah, I think there was actually a really interesting article in Energy Humanities, one of the other books, where the author Jean-François Mouhot, he draws parallels between slavery and fossil fuels in terms of their effect and their role in our economy, and how like fossil fuel lobbies and climate deniers have the same vested interests as the slave owners who were opposed to abolition.
And that's again, that comes back to this idea of self-protection and there being a limit to how much you can give up. So when we were talking about the whole polar bear thing, part of the reason that's a problem is because it will capture the imagination of the people who are already in line with the cause, but they'll probably still continue to drive the cars they drive and live the way they live, as well as perhaps donating the odd £5 to these charities. So that's the kind of the biggest problem, isn't it? It's this matter of it being a degree between a denier and someone who says they care.
Do we even like the term denier? Because it's obviously done as a parallel to Holocaust denier, isn't it?
Mm.
And it came out subsequent to that. And I've been around people who don't fully believe the science of climate change, and they do seem to have this slightly hectoring kind of belief in something that I can't quite see. But is it a problem that people who are fully cognizant of the problems call them deniers in the way that you'd call a Holocaust denier a denier? Is that part of the problem, do you think, or do you have to call a spade a spade?
Well, I think it doesn't need to be a really critical, nasty thing. It could, like, if we acknowledge that we're all deniers on some level, we're all in denial about what we're doing and how we're living and how we profit from other people's losses and like the natural world's losses, then it's more about coming together and acknowledging it as a whole population, rather than being divisive about it and saying, I'm a believer, you're a denier, or whatever.
Is the answer to be more positive? Because one of the things that comes out of this is that if you just say to people, everything's screwed, they sort of curl into a fetal ball and they say, well, I can't do anything. So is the answer to be a bit happy-clappy and say, come on, you like that flower there, don't you? Let's do what we can to make sure that another flower like that exists in future. Is that one of the messages in the book?
Yeah, one of the contributors to Walking on Lava, which is a collection of essays as part of the Dark Mountain Project, which was started to kind of bring together ecologically interested artists and writers. One of the contributors, Vinay Gupta, describes himself as part mystic, part engineer, descended from Scottish peasants and Indian scholars, which I think itself is enough. He talks about how apocalypse is a really unhelpful sort of premise, because it's immobilising and we don't really know what to do with that. And it's also, we don't really believe it, because we're always told about apocalypses of different kinds, like if it's nuclear, and they don't happen, so we're kind of conditioned to think that they're just scare stories. But if we take a more positive approach that's like celebratory of what's here, it could be more productive. But it's interesting because actually one of the editors of Walking on Lava, Paul Kingsnorth, he's famous for describing himself as a, quote, recovering environmentalist. He thinks it's naive, basically, to think that, oh, if we just find the right solution, if we just do a compelling enough campaign, we'll sort this problem out. He thinks it should be more about just accepting that we're basically screwed and that there's not really anything.
And do what?
Attempting to slow it down, surely? Maybe
I think,
not?
I think it's just kind of acknowledging that the end is already happening, and then, I mean, personally, I don't think that that would be very productive. I think it's a bit extreme, but it's interesting that the book compares the two approaches.
It shows you how far things have gone, really. That
there can be a post.
Yeah, and that post can somehow be seen by someone as constructive, because is his argument, therefore, that if you recognise the reality of it, you'll at least do something, even if it's to forestall the inevitable?
Yeah, I think also he's probably opposed to the kind of greenwashing of technology and sort of embedding solutions in the problem. If you think that the problem's like capitalism or whatever, then you think that just coming up with these green inventions is just putting a sticking plaster rather than actually, like...
Did you see that one which was that they found something that eats away plastic?
A bacteria.
It was an enzyme or something. Yeah, I think it was an enzyme that ate away plastic. And I saw that it was a splash of one of the papers. And at one level you thought, oh, great, phew.
Yeah,
but nothing to worry about there. They found a way of destroying all that plastic.
I can see how that must be counterproductive, because we've only just, this government in the UK has only just said that it will pass the most meagre of amendments to the way that we consume plastic in this country by saying that they'll ban single-use plastic. I mean, we need something so much more drastic than that. So to then say, oh, but it's okay because we found an enzyme that can process plastic, what does that even mean? It's surely we've only pushed the problem further down. Where's that waste from the enzyme going to end up?
Just finally, Claire, you read these books. Were you happy or sad? Were you depressed or positive having read them?
I think they help you accept that it's okay to be sad, that you shouldn't be scared of it, because that's the problem really, is when we're afraid of letting ourselves feel sad. There was one analogy that I remember, I think it was Nancy Menning in Morning Nature, she describes how if you haven't grieved for the death of your grandmother, if you haven't let yourself acknowledge that she's gone, then you're not going to be attending very well to the health of your mother, which I thought was just quite a good analogy for it. We need to accept the things that have gone and let ourselves feel sad about them if we're going to, like, care about what's still here.
Claire Saxby, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The classical period, whether it's history or its myths, has long provided fertile grounds for modern fiction. Robert Gray's extraordinary I, Claudius from 1934 and its sequel Claudius the God, and much more recently Madeline Miller's The Song of Achilles and Circe, which we heard about on last week's show, being only some of the better known and more successful examples. Part of the appeal, of course, is that the history, made so compelling by all the banishments, controversial returns, and of course literal and figurative backstabbing, is itself saturated with myths. As Stig mentioned earlier, the figures and reigns of Caligula and his successor Claudius are no exception. Caligula did not make his horse a senator, nor did he give it a marble manger, and he probably didn't commit incest either. Sorry. Another plus in drawing from history is the sheer number of minor characters whose opinions and perspective we haven't really had the time or perhaps inclination to focus on before. And this is what we get in Simon Turney's novel Caligula, reviewed in this week's TLS by Mary Beard. It is, Mary points out, a familiar device of fictional biography to pick a narrator who has privileged access to the main character, though is sufficiently marginal to the action and sufficiently unknown that they can be reinvented with impunity. Servants, secretaries, or as here, minor female relations, are common choices. Now, that minor female character in this instance is Livilla, Caligula's exiled sister. And on the line to tell us more is Mary Beard herself. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Hello. So before we go into the successes and failures of Simon Turney's novel, perhaps we could have a quick recap of the successes and failures of Caligula's reign. I mean, you know, what do we know or what do we think we know about it?
Well, it's gone down in history, partly thanks to the biography of Suetonius as a real low point or a real high point of imperial vice. And lots of the kind of stories that we know about being a bad emperor, thinking yourself as a god, casual acts of violence against the Senate, and added sprinkling of sexual excess, all that come with Caligula. Now, the difficulty about Caligula, and it's true for many Roman emperors, is that 99.9% of the material that has come down to us about him is from after his death. And there's a basic rule, really, that the reputation of any Roman emperor really depends on what their successors wanted it to be. And it was hugely convenient for the successors of Caligula, who was very nastily murdered in AD 41, it was very convenient for them to say he was rightly and justly murdered because he had been a monster. Now, I wouldn't in any way go so far as to say that, you know, poor old Caligula was a nice bloke who was tragically misunderstood, but certainly there's a huge justificatory animus which drives almost all the later accounts of his reign.
But there were some successes, because didn't he, in effect, sort of set the scene and enable Claudius's subsequent invasion of Britain?
He does move up northern Europe, and eventually then, in the famous story, gets the troops to pick up seashells on the shore. Now, you can, if you like, say, oh, look, you know, that's one of those nasty bits of spin. You know, what he was really doing was paving the way for a proper invasion. Or you can say, as most Romans said, it was a complete vanity project and he was bonkers anyway, and in the end he just decided to take a seashell collection home.
You mentioned Suetonius, and it's interesting because I imagine the vast majority of people who have a view on Caligula will never have read Suetonius. So after Suetonius, where does it get pushed into popular culture, do you think?
Well, I think recently it's the Malcolm McDowell, Gore Vidal movie.
Yeah.
The Penthouse movie, you know, famous for both representing, well, giving you a glimpse of the real excesses of the reign of Caligula, but also had a load of famous actresses and actors in. Was it 60s or 70s?
Yeah. There's a lot of nudity in it, wasn't there?
There
was a hell of a lot of nudity,
yeah.
And a hell of a lot of a kind of Caligula and sisters, because in this account, of course, they were having incest, sort of trotting naked through the grass. And the puzzle for most viewers, I think, was why these famous actors, like Gielgud and people like this, why they'd actually gone along with being in this extraordinary penthouse movie. And the story got out, and I don't know if it's true, that there was two completely separate shoots, and the famous actors all believed they were doing a serious biography of Caligula. And you know, in the evening, the penthouse pets emerged on a completely different timescale.
What a compelling theory.
It is a wonderful theory.
But presumably Gore Vidal's name on it was, because by that point, was he well-respected by that point, Vidal?
Well, he must
I think
have
he was,
been.
Yeah.
Yes, he must have been.
It's interesting, though, that the film is, I think, still banned in some countries that you would expect it not to be. I think it might be banned in Canada.
When I was giving a course a few years ago on images of the Roman Emperor and how they had been kind of put into popular culture, the highlight of the course was not only this seeing the movie, but also seeing the promo videos that were made for it, where the penthouse pets came on screen and explained what they thought of Caligula.
Well, that sounds good. To be honest, I've not seen this film, and is it high camp fun, or is it slightly more seedy than that?
It feels to me rather more seedy,
yeah.
But you are looking at Gielgud. I think Helen Mirren's in it, and Peter O'Toole.
Oh,
and Malcolm McDowell is the is in the title lead. He must have known what was happening in the evenings.
There does seem to be such a strong draw then, because I'm thinking now of the BBC adaptation of I, Claudius, and the names in that. I mean, altogether different production. But the names in that, Derek Jacobi, John Hurt.
And you know, Caligula is, you know, an extremely powerful episode in that whole BBC I, Claudius series. And there's they actually add to some of the blood, gore and disgust, because I remember being, when I watched it first, really shocked when Caligula actually effectively murders his sister who is pregnant by him in this version, by actually cutting her open and getting the fetus out. I mean, you couldn't show British telly now, I don't think.
There's an interesting point there, because Thea mentioned I, Claudius, which is one of my favourite novels. I've read it a few times, and I think it is wonderful. If you're trying to write about this area, like Simon Turney's book, how large is the shadow of I, Claudius over this whole genre, do you think?
Well, you know, you say that you love the book, and you know, I guess that there's a lot of people who are with you, Stig, but I have to say,
are you about to ruin my dreams here, Mary? You're telling me it's not very good.
Well, I've always, I was one of those people, and must be many of us, who saw the TV series before we read the book.
Yeah.
And actually, I always thought the television series had much more oomph in it than the book. There was really dreary, long patches where they were out of Rome and fighting people in the book, as I remember. But I guess, nevertheless, that you're right, that in some ways these people are always talking to I, Claudius. You can't write about an early Roman emperor without sort of seeing Graves over your shoulder. And of course, Graves was a translator of Suetonius as well as the writer of these novels.
I think he didn't like being famous for the novels. I've got a feeling I read somewhere that on his grave it said
poet. He did it just to make money.
Yeah, and his grave said poeta.
And that's
what he wanted to be known as. And of course, everyone only knew him for I, Claudius.
Well, those of us who read Suetonius know him because he did the Penguin translation. Yeah. But I think that, in some ways that partly explains what Turney is doing, because what Graves did for us, really, whether you like the novels or not particularly, is that he established this idea of Claudius as the slightly eccentric, slightly bumbling, reluctant emperor through whose eyes we can see the goings on. I mean, in some ways, in Graves' novel, Claudius, until he becomes emperor, is a bit part through whose eyes we view the goings on in the imperial court. And what Turney does is he takes that image head on, and relying on some quite good, actually, modern work on Claudius and his relationship to Caligula, he says, look, we bought the ancient and then particularly the Gravesian version of the nice old Uncle Claudius who's reluctantly drawn to the throne. Actually, what about wondering whether Claudius wasn't the evil genius behind all this? And that story that is so famous and repeated often, that Caligula is murdered on the Palatine near the Imperial Palace, and it's one of those, oh my God, what do we do next kind of moments in Assassination. They kill Caligula. They don't quite know what to do, whether they should restore the Democratic Republic, and then a posse of the Praetorian Guard, whizzing through the palace, and they kind of draw back a curtain, and there's poor old Claudius hiding, saying, I'm terribly scared. And they say, oh, come on, we'll make him the emperor then.
almost as a joke.
Almost as a joke. So Claudius kind of becomes emperor, just because he happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, that has been a story which, it has delighted people. It's taken its really, really strong place in the Claudian and the Caligulan mythology. Turney says, as some scholars have suggested, look, come on, guys. Normally, the person who has planned the assassination, normally, is the person who comes to the throne next. How come we have believed this, extraordinary bit of spin that the Claudian regime must have put out afterwards, saying, oh, I never wanted to do it, but I'm just kind of saving my country. And so he nicely, and it is in a sense a reply to Graves, I guess, he rather nicely has Claudius as the real wicked guy. I mean, Caligula's not great. He's got frightful issues. He's from a dysfunctional family. You couldn't expect the poor kid to be normal. And he certainly isn't. But Claudius, it's Claudius who masterminds the getting rid of Caligula, and then plunks himself, as was the plan all along, on the throne.
And just on a final point, Livilla, who we get this from her perspective, Caligula's sister, she's not exactly an uncomplicated figure, is she?
No.
Historically, at least.
No. And what you find, one of the nice things that Turney's book does, and the Roman imperial family is ripe for this, is that you actually see the inevitable dysfunction of any kind of personal relationship when you are in that kind of murderous bit of self-regarding power politics. You know, people are married off, people's sisters betray them, you can't trust anybody, this is court culture in which everybody is looking at everybody else. You know, you are going to be betrayed by your best friend or by your uncle or whatever. And there is no character in any of this who emerges psychically unscathed.
When you're reading books like this, I love, as Theo knows, I love historical fiction. I find it's a sort of guilty of pleasure of mine. But I'm not an expert in anything. You're an expert in the classical world. Do you have to switch that part of your brain off? Or are you constantly saying, Suetonius doesn't say that. That's not right. They'd never wear that thing there. What are you doing?
Well, in some ways, that's the pleasure of historical fiction, isn't it? When when it's your period. You know, part of the pleasure rather than the irritation. Say, oh, they've got that wrong, or oh, you know, God, that's a clever idea, because you know, ancient history is so happily full of gaps,
yeah,
that a novelist can actually put this together in a way that a factual historian wouldn't dare, in a way that can make you kind of sit up and say, oh, hi, that's an interesting idea.
That's a
possibility. So I rather like that slightly kind of finger-wagging relationship I have to these texts.
I can imagine
because
that.
Because it's a joke.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, we can't take this too seriously. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for this review.
Pleasure.
I love a bit of historical fiction.
Yeah, I have so many questions as well, because the the cast is so huge for this kind of work, and there are so many characters, and we feel like we know them all. You want to know how they've all been translated in this most recent work. How does Messalina come across? You know, the wife of Claudius,
yeah,
who's so hateful and easy to hate in everything else that you've read or seen.
In Italy, are they when Italian school? Are these, is this like the Tudors for us? That you know, you constantly get sort of. Yes, what you do at school, you learn about the Roman Empress. Do you do that in Italy?
I don't know. I mean, remember, I didn't go to an Italian school, but you probably do. I mean, it's the foundation of modern civilization, I suppose.
And do Italians regard it as that? I presume they must be.
Well, it's very complicated in Italy because, of course, Italy didn't exist until the mid to late 1800s.
That's right, yeah.
So
Italy is younger than Notts County Football Club.
Quite possibly.
As my history teacher once told me.
Good to know.
We're about to have David Horsepool in to talk about this, but talk about football and history.
It's an excellent segue, that.
But no,
kicking a ball.
Yeah, Italy is younger than Notts County.
Yeah, well, there you go. So, I mean, whether or not they would trace a... You know, it's difficult to trace a direct line back, though obviously Mussolini was always nodding later.
Yeah.
He came along and he was always nodding back to these days of grandeur. So
it didn't turn out that well when they have done that in the past.
No, well, I mean, you know, all civilizations are made to fail eventually.
Hmm. Oh, thank you for that, Theo.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Now, why on earth is the TLS an esteemed organ of intellectual and cultural heft concerning itself with the exigencies of association football? As I'm sure an email to me will read this week, after publication of David Horsepool's meditation on the life and work of former Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger. Well, Wenger was a significant figure in modern British culture, a manager who sought to make the beautiful game more beautiful, who encouraged an influx of talent from Europe, a figure that united, as it were, people in admiration and respect. He's also been published in the TLS, of course, as one of the signatories of a letter imploring Britain to stay in the EU. So it is perhaps fitting that Wenger has no place in post-Brexit Britain. Like all political careers, managerial careers must end in failure. And Arsenal's disinterested and weak performance had led to deafening clarion calls for Wenger to go. To judge his impact and historical context, we're joined by history editor and Arsenal fan, it must be said, David Horspool. David, hello.
Hello.
Do you think people will welcome the fact that we're talking in the TLS about Arsene Wenger?
I don't suppose most of them will, because even if they like football, most of them won't like Arsenal. But
people like Arsenal a bit, you know, I think.
They used to, and maybe they do again because they're not very threatening to whoever else you support. So maybe everyone does like Arsenal again.
What is the mythology of Arsenal? Because you talk about this in the piece, that all football clubs, particularly if they don't have success, need mythology.
Well, yes, I think that a football club's myth can be a substitute for success, because it's in the nature of sport that you can't be successful all the time. I suppose, you know, fans of Manchester City at the moment would say, well, we don't have a myth about our club. Our club's just the best club in the country. But it hasn't always been thus.
It's so newbie as well, Man City being good. I know they're good in the 70s, but
I mean, know Man City fans who are not particularly happy with the current state of affairs.
No, my dad is one of them, I think, because it's won through pure money rather than...
Oh, and they don't like that?
No. No, I don't think you would if you were a proper fan.
I just think you have
it's
to
just
accept...
a competition over who has most money.
Well, I think that's what you have to accept, don't you?
There is a bit of that, but it's not long ago since Leicester City won the league. So it is possible to kind of buck those trends. But I think those myths that I was thinking about, other clubs that have quite strong myths, and in fact two of them that do have recently sacked their managers, West Ham and Everton. So West Ham know themselves as the Academy, Everton call themselves the School of Science. Both of them have a sort of adherence to fine, free-flowing football, and neither of their managers, although they both did what they were asked to do, which was keep them in the Premier League, keep the bucks coming in, have found favour, and particularly at Everton. Sam Allardyce, yeah. Ex-England manager, has just been sacked. Basically for doing what he was asked to do. That Everton were about to be relegated, he kept them in the Premier League.
But they were,
and he's out.
Because I'm from Nottinghamshire, and Forest have the same thing. Nottingham Forest, I mean, they're so insignificant now, it's barely worth thinking of. But they were always known as a team that passed the ball well, and the beautiful game. And Arsenal have had a kind of conflicting reputation, haven't they? Because at one point, they were known as boring, boring Arsenal.
Absolutely.
And then under Wenger... Were they changing the mythology under Wenger then to becoming something...
Well, I argue, if my piece can be said to have an argument, that there was some kind of connection between what Wenger encouraged and something from Arsenal's more distant past, which was the arrival of the great manager Herbert Chapman in the 20s. He stayed there till the 30s. And he did revolutionise Arsenal's approach. He made them this kind of club of... almost of the establishment, and there is a sense in which Wenger got back to that sort of self-identity. And of course, all that works while you're bringing home the bacon, which for the first 10 years of his 22 years, Arsene Wenger certainly did. And while he could do it and produce this wonderful, free-flowing, high-scoring football... He was very, very popular beyond Arsenal, I think.
But it is a while since he did bring home
said
bacon. Do we see Arsene Wenger as one of the last kind of long haul emperors? You know, along with Alex Ferguson, who were brought in and allowed to stay, and now we've moved to this model of allowed to fail. Yeah,
well,
whereas now we're in this model of tight margins and justifying the huge amounts that we spent.
I think there is certainly something to that. It's always said of Ferguson that he was within a match or two of getting the sack. The same can't be said of Wenger, because he arrived and was instantly fantastically successful. They won the double of FA Cup and league in the first year that he was in charge. So he didn't have to sort of be allowed to fail. Perhaps he sort of led his career in reverse. He saved up his failures for later. Although Arsenal did win the FA Cup three times in the last four years.
Yeah, but they were but they were loyal to him, weren't they?
The board were loyal. The fans got less and less loyal. And this is also, I think, partly to do with this myth. There's a double thing. Partly it's just cold, hard cash that Wenger, up until a couple of seasons ago, always got Arsenal into the Champions League, where more money is to be made from television, selling more seats. And he'd done that 17 years in a row, which no other club, even including Manchester United, had managed to do. And while he did that, while fans weren't particularly happy because they weren't actually winning anything while qualifying for this competition, it kept the board happy because the money kept rolling in. And now for the second season, they failed to do that, and Arsene's out on his ear.
And are the fans, because you know, you make an excellent point that Wenger began his career when the first iPhone was released.
Yeah, during his time.
And the Wenger must go, was it Wenger must go? Wenger
became a meme,
didn't it?
Absolutely. You would see Wenger out not only at Arsenal matches, but you'd see people holding up Wenger out signs at ice hockey matches in Calgary and you know, in sumo and in Tokyo or whatever. And he managed to resist all that. And in a way, there were some fairly traditional expressions of that as well. People flew planes over matches saying Wenger out, and he even made a joke about it after his last match because a plane flew over that said "Merci Arsène," and he was asked about it, and he said, "Yes, I think they put the wrong banner on today."
And there was Piers Morgan, famously, he was talked about it all the time. How vicious did it get toward him? Because football always strikes me, going to it when I was younger, it's far more vicious than you'd want it to be in terms of how it's supported. And I know it's important, you know, more important than life and death and all those cliches, but it always surprises me how viciously it is supported and how angry people feel about it.
Yeah, I never cease to be amazed. I've been going to Arsenal for almost 40 years, and I do never cease to be amazed by how horrible fans can be, not particularly to other teams' players, but to their own players and their own manager, how little patience they have for people who are clearly trying their best, you know, 99% of the time. And of course, the justification, which is a perfectly reasonable one, is that these guys are paid an enormous amount of money to run around. And if they're not running around enough...
And also the club are charging... I mean, it seems to me that once football has been so permeated by money, and it costs... I imagine a season ticket at Arsenal is just an exorbitant amount of money.
It is.
And individual tickets are a lot, and they're getting paid a lot, and Sky and BT are shoving loads of money in. Does that provide an excuse for that? Because once the same thing happened in baseball, interestingly, in America, once they were allowed to do free agency move, and the players went from earning 30 grand a year to 3 million in about 5 years. And everyone turned on the players because they were doing the job that we all want to do for ourselves. And they're not only doing it, they're becoming millionaires for it. Is that does that provide the justification, do you think?
Yes, I think that partly does. And in Wenger's case, he was incredibly committed and sort of worked 7 days a week, he always said, and I believe him, but he was extraordinarily well paid. I think he was paid something like £8 million a year to do the job. So that was another reason for people who were disaffected. And by the end, I would include myself as a fan among them, but I wasn't, you know, shouting for the rooftops or starting memes, but quietly discussing things in libraries about him.
Yeah. Well, I found this amazing. You said that Arsenal, the preferred myth has been of class. Marble halls, flowers in the opposition colours in the director's dining room on match days, old Etonians on the board. I didn't realise Arsenal were posh,
well,
did you?
The fact that I always thought of them as the posh club goes to show, I mean, me with a passing interest in
Absolutely.
Football really goes to show how pervasive that myth is.
Yeah. Definitely. And the ridiculous old Etonians on the board thing, I mean, I think the owner of Arsenal, the two majority shareholders are from overseas, are American and Uzbek. But the chairman is still a man who rejoices in the name of Sir Chips Keswick. I'm pretty sure he must be an old Etonian. Certainly his predecessor, Peter Hillwood, was.
Right,
and Peter Hillwood's predecessor, Dennis Hillwood, was too.
Related?
And famously, the Queen Mother is said to have been an Arsenal fan because she was very keen on Dennis Compton, who played for Arsenal. He and his brother, Dennis and Leslie, both played for Arsenal. So there is this kind of slightly ludicrous...
lineage.
Yeah, class thing going on there.
Just finally, I hate to mention Brexit, but why not? was Wenger kind of a bastion of pro-Europeanism? Do you think? I was interested. Jurgen Klopp was interviewed in Channel 4 News like a month ago, the Liverpool manager, and he extraordinarily anti-Brexit.
Yeah.
In a place which is pretty pro-Brexit, you know, certain wards of that area would be very Liverpool, pro-Brexit in Liverpool, I'd have thought. Do you think, and Wenger, of course, signed that letter that came to the TLS,
as did Per Mertesacker, the club captain.
Yeah. So do you think there's an argument that football was a kind of bastion of Europeanism of
well,
or not?
Yeah, I think, and Arsene Wenger certainly was the first manager to introduce sort of leagues and leagues of foreign players and fielded a team with no English players whatsoever in it, although that wasn't, I don't think, his preference. So certainly he has a European outlook. He's French. My brother always says he's not really French. He's German. He's, in fact, from Alsace.
Yeah.
So he has that kind of all-round European outlook. And, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what was remarkable about Jurgen Klopp was not that he was willing to be drawn on whether he thought Brexit was a good or a bad idea, but he's willing to talk about it at length. And I think that's a door that Wenger has also opened. He's famously willing to answer questions on almost anything at his press conferences.
Was he?
And journalists would get copy, you know, asking him about all sorts of things about the political
situation. Because he was kind of clever.
Yeah, I think he's an economics graduate. I mean, he's interested in the wider world as well as being a total football obsessive.
On one final note, can I just say Liverpool voted to remain?
Ward, that's why I said wards of Liverpool,
oh,
which would have voted
okay.
to. I know you're from Liverpool and you want to defend its honour.
No, and they're in the Champions League final, which is a very European thing for
exactly.
them to do.
Okay. Right, as you were.
Yeah, okay, thank you, dear. let's stop now. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to David Horspool, Mary Beard and Claire Saxby. Thea, do you want to plug festivals?
So next week we've got the live podcast,
yes.
Lucy and I in Bath on the 24th, talking to Robert Webb and Margaret Drabble.
Just a standard podcast
very same,
lineup,
just the normal
it's cliche,
day for
it's a cliche lineup.
The same day you're in Hay,
I'm off to Hay, and then I'm doing talking to Ian, not for the podcast. Well, we might try and record it. Talk to Ian McEwan about translating his films onto the screen.
Well, perfect. And then the week after that, I'm in Hay. And then I think we can all have a little rest.
Yeah, too many literary festivals. Do find yourself a copy of the paper, of course, which also contains some fine pieces on popular science, female gamekeepers, near death by coma, and an interview with Bret Easton Ellis. They're not all connected. Next week, Thea and Lucy are on the road trip to Bath, so that's what the podcast will be, won't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Hooray, I'll take a break.
It will be a day late, just in case anyone sets their clocks by
and
it.
And panics. So it'll be Friday morning.
It'll be Friday.
Friday morning, Thea, Lucy, Margaret Drabble and Robert Webb.
Exactly.
Enjoy that. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.